Greetings, friends. This is John Haspel, and I am the Dhamma teacher at Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey. The podcast will begin in a moment. Please visit crossrivermeditation.com for additional podcasts, Dhamma articles, and a calendar of our weekly classes and monthly and yearly retreats. We rely on donations from our listeners to provide these talks. If you find this talk helpful in developing your understanding of the Dhamma, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. Thank you, and enjoy the talk.
Thank you. It's just when this vibrates, it makes it quite annoying. Thank you for the muktuk work. Joey, yeah. It worked.
You got it?
Just logistical stuff. Is everybody settled in, and did everybody get a schedule and a book? I know the rooms got switched around. Mm-hmm. Nobody's missing anything. You're all... Anybody have any questions or concerns about our stay here for the next few days? Okay. If anything comes up, you're uncomfortable, you're just not sure, just let me know or let Maura know. It's my job to make your retreat as comfortable and peaceful as possible. So if there's anything that comes up, either with the facility or what comes out of my mouth, please let me know. It's important. You came here for your retreat. I talked a little bit about the purpose of a retreat in general. The purpose of this retreat, within the context of what the Buddha taught, is to awaken. And awakening is possible in any moment. It can happen this moment or the next moment. It could happen for any one of you this weekend. It's not necessarily, and gratefully so, hinging on what comes out of my mouth. Awakening, I'm going to talk a little bit about what the Buddha said, described it. Awakening happens in your mind when a certain clarity enters your mind when you've let go of all concepts. So the Buddha taught right view. He taught a different view. Hopefully this weekend we'll all develop a more clear view of who we are and what our purpose is in this world. And that purpose is to awaken. It's to recognize all the things that are blocking us from that. Again, we by changing the way we view our lives and the experiences in our lives, by changing the way we view ourselves, meaning our ego personality, we change our experience. And we change our experience from what the Buddha identified as dukkha to one of lasting peace and happiness. We're no longer affected by what goes on in the world. That doesn't mean that it's going to change. Life is going to continue to unfold. Life in the phenomenal world is subject to stress and unhappiness. It's subject to things changing that we don't usually want to change. Initially, the Buddha described that as sickness, aging, and death. That was the first things that he recognized as troublesome. And then he realized that there's no way out of that. So how can we live in a physical body subject to sickness, aging, and death, and yet not be preoccupied with it, not lose our minds over it? That's the original heedlessness or mindlessness, is we're so preoccupied with maintaining something, maintaining a pleasant feeling, or at least a safe feeling in this uncertain world, that we lose our minds. We become so distracted by it. Upon his awakening, the Buddha gave us four noble truths, and that's what he taught, was that, and that they're either stated as life is dukkha, life is stressful, or there is. And I think there is dukkha, there is stress, is a little bit more accurate and probably more in keeping with what the Buddha intended to teach. So he didn't teach that life is just awful, and so why even bother? But he said that as a consequence of living in this phenomenal world and in a phenomenal body, something that arises due to phenomena, there's going to be stress, there's going to be unhappiness, there's going to be disenchantment and disappointment. There's no way around it. And it's not something that we should look to avoid. The purpose of the Dhamma is not to avoid that or not to experience it. The purpose is not to react to it, to recognize it. It's simply part of being here. Having a physical body, we're subject to that disappointment, disenchantment, and unhappiness. But then the Buddha described a way to not react. And his great discovery was that it was clinging to things. As simple as that sounds, and it's so simple that it's hard to accept, it's due to our clinging, or this ego personality, clinging to things, that causes dukkha. In a, even a more accurate way of saying is the proliferation of dukkha, because dukkha is going to be part of our lives. But we don't have to experience it constantly. We don't have to get caught up in it to the point of anxiety, compulsive behavior, or addictive behavior. We can just let it be as it occurs to us and move on to the next moment mindfully without a reaction. And that's that part of the Third Noble Truth. Cessation of dukkha is possible. How is it possible? By not reacting to the things that happen in our lives. Again, these stressors are going to be there. We're all subject to sickness, aging, and death. We're all subject due to impermanence and uncertainty of losing things that we want, whether it's losing people that we care deeply for, whether through a physical death or just relationships changing. Losing things that we value, such as a job, our possessions, money, and identity. You know, we all build an identity, and that's constantly challenged. Sometimes when people lose their identity, it happens in such a way that they have a mental breakdown. They have such a strong identity as something, it's lost, and then they're lost. That's part of this stress and unhappiness. It's part of dukkha. It's a severe example of it. We all experience this at some level. We're all going to experience loss, whether it's physical, spiritual, emotional. We're all going to have challenges to who we think we are. We're all going to get slapped in the face a little bit every now and then. Something's going to happen. We're also going to experience the great highs of life. We're going to have things that bring us great joy. And the only problem with that is that we cling to that too. And then that ends, and that brings more unhappiness. So let me get to what the Buddha said about all that. In the Simsapa Sutta, Simsapa, the Buddha describes the purpose of his teachings. This is why he did what he did. And what have I taught? I teach the nature of dukkha, or stress. I teach the origination of dukkha, that's clinging. I teach that cessation of dukkha is possible, and I teach that the Eightfold Path is the path leading to cessation of dukkha. This is what I have taught. The entirety of the Buddha Dhamma is what the Buddha just said. This is what he taught. He taught understanding dukkha, understanding where it came from, and abandoning that. That's awakening to the Second Noble Truth, abandoning clinging. He taught that that any human being can do this. That line in the Third Noble Truth is something that always kind of intrigued me because it's so obvious and so simple. Why is it even there? It's there for us to remember over and over again that we're human beings, and as human beings, cessation of dukkha is possible. There's nothing, we don't need to have any special powers. We don't need any special powers given to us. We don't have to be special in any way. We don't have to find a special teacher. We don't have to find a special Dhamma. We found it. Cessation of dukkha is possible. He could have said, cessation of dukkha is possible for each and every one of you, because that's what he means by that simple line. And then he said, the way we do it is through the Eightfold Path. It's not just meditation. There's seven other factors. But it's not something else either. You know, the Buddha taught an Eightfold Path. He didn't teach something, an Eightfold Path and something else. All the other conceptual teachings that point back to the Eightfold Path are there to support the Eightfold Path. And we're talking a little bit coming up about dependent origination and how that's so misunderstood, or even the concept of emptiness. You know, the Buddha taught all of those things within the context of the Eightfold Path, and the Eightfold Path is one factor of the Four Noble Truths. So he was only concerned about awakening to that. No great mystical experience. Nothing that wasn't achievable by each and every human being who took to the Dhamma. The Buddha goes on, and why have I taught these things? Because they are connected with the goal. They relate to the rudiments of the mindful life. That's what the Buddha means about mindfulness. And within the context of the Eightfold Path. These teachings develop disenchantment and dispassion. So what does that mean? A lot of times our minds will go, does that mean we're supposed to look at life as just, blech, I don't like any of it? What it means is that we're just not supposed to be joined to it. We don't develop an identity based on our life. We're fully present with each and every occurrence in our lives. We take great joy or great sorrow in what happens. And then we move on. We don't identify ourselves with it. That's the teachings on emptiness. The teachings on emptiness simply mean that we're empty of any attachment to whatever goes on. We don't have to attach ourselves to things in order to have them be in our lives or have them be significant. In fact, if you really want to deeply embrace anything or anyone, let go of the attachment and see it for what it is. If you really want to be with someone in this present moment, stop seeing them through the prism of your own judgments and see who's truly in front of you. And then you have a presence, you know. And other people will feel that presence. The more, I think Maura is really a good example. I don't mean to put you on a spot, but Maura knows how to be with very, very sick people and let them know that she's in front of them because she connects with them mindfully. It's an astonishing thing when you do it. Each and every one of you, have done that too at some point in your Dhamma practice. You realize that you're more present with people. That's the kind of mindfulness that the Buddha was talking about. Nothing magical or mystical. We don't leave our bodies. We don't have some kind of all-encompassing understanding of all the grand intricacies of the universe. We're present. We're in this present moment. That's awakening. You know, that's what the Buddha taught. There was a lot of mystical teachings around at the time of the Buddha. And when those questions were put to the Buddha, what about bilocation? What about omniscience? And the Buddha, he'd poo-poo it. And I can almost see him, you know. Don't worry about that. Wake up. You know, those things are possible. They're possible for anyone. They're a big distraction. Wake up. You won't need them. They won't concern you. Wake up. End your suffering. End your confusion. That's the point of this weekend. And again, it's not that we're all going to wake up by Sunday. We might, you know. If you don't take it all too seriously, you'll have a chance. You know, that's another aspect of this. Don't take any of this personally. Don't take it too seriously that you can't be aware of the present moment. We're not trying to get anywhere. We're trying to let go of all the things that we built that we call us. That's what emptiness is talking about. I'll read that last line again. These teachings develop disenchantment and dispassion, meaning disenchantment and dispassion for the things that we're holding on to. We're not supposed to turn our lives on the world. We're supposed to recognize that there's no reason to hold on to any of it. Disenchantment and dispassion. These teachings develop cessation of stress and unhappiness. They bring calm and direct knowledge. These teachings develop self-awakening and unbinding. Unbinding is the opposite of joining, of attaching ourselves to things, to objects, to ideas. These teachings develop self-awakening and unbinding. Self-awakening, it's up to us. Nobody else can give it to us. You know, there's nothing we need to do except take to the Dhamma. It's a matter of self-awakening, understanding. It's a matter of self-understanding. When the Buddha describes awakening to the Four Noble Truths, the first aspect of that is understanding dukkha. What is awakening? The Buddha responds, understanding stress. That's the first aspect. And where does stress arise? Within us. You know, so it's up to us to recognize it and unbind from it. This is why I have taught them. Therefore, your practice is in contemplating and understanding one thing. And then he goes on to a few things. This is stress. This is the origination of stress. This is the cessation of stress. Your practice is contemplating and understanding. This is the path leading to the cessation of stress. Understanding that. And so the emphasis I'm giving on in this opening talk is that's kind of the point of this weekend. It should be a very, very light, gentle weekend for each and every one of you, because it's in that softness and in that gentleness that the Dhamma comes over us and comes over our minds. It's not in a hard striving. It's not in trying to force an understanding. It's in the gentleness and the peacefulness of our own minds that we awaken to the Dhamma. The Buddha struggled for 6 years. Probably nobody worked as hard as understanding as the Buddha did during those 6 years, to the point that he almost starved himself to death, thinking that it was in self-denial that he would gain an understanding. The legend is that he lived on a grain of rice or a bean for a long, long time, to the point that he almost starved himself to death. The whole story of the life of the Buddha is significant, because what he showed by what he went through, he left the palace grounds, left a life of luxury, renounced the pleasures of the world, because he knew that, not that they were bad in a moral sense, but that they were a huge distraction to his awakening, that he couldn't awaken living in his father's kingdom. And so he wandered around northern India. And he studied with some of the greatest spiritual minds of the time. At that time in the history of the world, it's often referred to as the axial period, meaning that it was a crucial period in the awakening of humanity, not in the Buddhist sense, but just coming of age. Socrates was arising around that time. A little bit later came Jesus Christ. A little before that was the great prophets. But they're all in that period of time known as the axial age, and the Buddha comes up in that age when, for the first time in human history, people were reaching beyond their own noses and trying to gain some understanding of what's going on and how do we relate, and how do we improve our lot in this world. There wasn't a lot of self-reflection on how can I place this in a context. The context that came up before the Buddha was the Vedas. And I won't get into the story of how they arose, but that was a common teaching at the time of the Buddha. A very magical and mystical teaching, by the way. And so the Buddha studied with these two great masters. He learned two of the most well-recognized and recognized as a very effective meditation techniques. And the Buddha rejected it all because it wasn't developing in him an understanding of the problem, suffering. And he recognized that dukkha was the not so much that it's suffering itself, but the big distraction that we all have with dukkha. And that's what got the Buddha to get into this whole thing. So he studied hard. He put his heart and soul into it. Again, almost to the point of dying. He passed out one day on the side of the road, and this little girl came and offered the Buddha a little bowl of milk with some rice in it and nursed the Buddha back to health. Imagine that, you know, little girl coming up and changing the course of history because she saved the Buddha. And on reflection, the Buddha realized that hard striving, that beating the heck out of yourself, was not the way to go. We don't need to put that kind of effort into this. In fact, what the effort that we need is a gentle effort. And the Buddha found that out by saying, none of this is working. I'm going to take it easy and I'm just going to sit here until I awaken. And he sat under the Bodhi tree. And he remembered a meditation technique that he had used as a five-year-old boy. And it's a simple shamatha vipassana. He remembered this technique of being focused on his breath, bringing his mind into the present moment and letting everything else go, not being caught up in his thoughts anymore. And for the first time in 6 years, the Buddha began to be very gentle and very accepting of whatever happened to himself. And what happened to himself was every one of his confused and views of attachment came up in his own mind. In the legend of the Buddha, in the story that's depicted as Mara, the benevolent god Mara that came after the Buddha and threw armies at the Buddha and threw wild animals at the Buddha, and Mara's beautiful daughters at the Buddha. And every one of these things occurred in the Buddha's mind. And every time that they came up, the Buddha recognized them as a distraction, as an attachment, as impermanent, put them aside, and he came back to his breath. He practiced shamatha vipassana until eventually, I know you've all heard this story again, but it points to being very gentle. As he sat there and all of these terrible things were being thrown at the Buddha or arising in his mind, he came back to the gentleness of his own breath, the gentleness and the mindfulness of his own presence. And he did that long enough with the right amount of effort and the right mindfulness that he awakened, that his mind cleared. And at that point, he became the Buddha. Not out of any extraordinary effort, out of the simple effort of recognizing keeping his mind within that framework of the Eightfold Path. When Mara threw the armies at the Buddha didn't scream. He didn't respond in an irate manner. He didn't curse at Mara or curse at his situation. He remained within right speech, and he remained silent also. The action that he took was to stay in his mindfulness. He practiced right mindfulness. His view to do that arose out of right view, out of understanding what was happening, of deeply ingrained understanding of dukkha and not wanting anything to be other, any different than it was, except himself here. When the Buddha awakened, he touched the ground with his right hand. I think we've all seen that picture of the Buddha sitting there. That's him saying to the world, I have overcome the world, meaning that I've let go of all clinging, craving, desire, and aversion. I'm now the awakened one. I'm not attached to anything. And then his next thing was, there will be no more rebirths, meaning there's nothing left inside of him to keep creating the drama of dukkha moment by moment. It's over for him. And he spent the next 45 years of his life teaching just what he just said, you know, how to put that all aside. So this weekend, we're in this retreat, we're in this somewhat protected, quiet, peaceful environment. As best you can, keep your mindfulness within that framework of the Eightfold Path. As things come up in your life, and meaning in the next few days, watch your reactions to it and weigh your reactions against the Eightfold Path. And this is not in a way to judge yourself harshly. If you find yourself engaged in wrong speech, for instance, even if it's just in your own mind, don't judge yourself harshly. The way to change it is to recognize it, that it's part of you in that moment. Bring your mind into the present moment, acknowledge it, and come back into the present moment. And be more mindfully aware of it in the next moment. Right effort in the Eightfold Path is simply the effort to put into awakening, to put the time into a meditation practice, but also to develop our understanding of the Dhamma. You know, when the Buddha told the monks, the Vinayapitaka is the third book of the Pali Canon, and it's the whole book is basically rules for monks how to act within a spiritual community. And one of those rules is, in relation to right speech, is when you come together as a sangha, you only talk about the Dhamma, or you talk about the Dhamma in a way that supports it for each other. So I'm not trying to be restrictive over the next 3.5 days, but this is your retreat. You know, it's your time to get into and experience the Dhamma in a way that is as free of distraction from the outside world as possible. That's why we're here. Doesn't mean we shouldn't have fun, doesn't mean we shouldn't laugh. But this is also a quiet, peaceful time. It's a time to go within. It's a time to be very gentle with ourselves. You know, we don't have a lot to do except kind of hang out, listen to me a little bit, and be gentle with yourself. We're going to do a lot of meditation. We're going to do a lot of healing stuff. Denise is going to... We're going to have a few sessions with Denise. Maura and Matt are going to move us in a very gentle way. And we're going to sit. We're going to be quiet. We're going to see what's there. That's it. You can go home now. It's 7 o'clock. Does anybody have any general questions about integrating the Eightfold Path into your life and into your, and as part of your Dhamma practice? You know, it's one thing to come and sit on our cushions and make that commitment once or twice a day, or come to class once a week, but it's another thing to really integrate it into our lives. So this would be a good weekend to talk about that, because I meant to put it up there, what I mean by developing lasting peace and happiness, or the truth of happiness, is it's something that it's the way we live our lives, you know, in this present moment. There's a process of getting there, but it's really not a goal. You know, we start living it when we start living it. And again, coming back to the idea of retreat, this weekend is an opportunity to live it. There's no other distractions. There's no reason why we can't fully settle into the Eightfold Path. I'm going to talk more about that. You all have that book that I hope you find it helpful. I was thinking this past week, I realize that I talk a lot about the Eightfold Path and the Four Noble Truths. That's all there is to talk about. You know, this is what the Buddha taught. This is the way to awakening. There's other subjects that support it, but everything comes back to living our lives within that framework. Joy, did you have a question, or did I?
I was responding to your invitation to ask questions about that, and I wanted to thank Deb for her beautiful question about what is an example of right speech.
Yeah.
One of the things that would be very helpful and useful to me, and I hope you don't mind me piggybacking on your question, but it was so well put, is perhaps to talk about concrete examples, which I'm sorry if that's, I apologize in advance if that's basic, but that has been helpful to me. And if, as we move through this weekend, perhaps you could identify examples of things that we're doing and how they are following the Eightfold Path, like our sitting practice is one thing. What is that illustrative of? Taking our meals thoughtfully and in silence, which I absolutely love. That is a profoundly nourishing practice. Charlie would love that if we would do that at home, I think.
The first thing you got to get is a muck tuck, Charlie.
I get it. I know. More luckily, we've got muck tuck. And so, to be more clear, if we could talk about right speech is, you know, truthful, necessary, helpful, kind. It is not gossip, you know, blah. Right intention is truthful, helpful. It is not greedy, deceitful. It just, that would be my humble ask.
Thank you so much. This is what Deb said before, what you just said right now, is the reason why we have a Sangha, you know, to bring these things up. And to get our focus on what is most important. This is, you said that it's very basic. That this is basic. There's nothing magical or mystical about what the Buddha taught. He was concerned with that one singular thing, putting aside everything that causes unhappiness and disenchantment. And he noticed that a lot of it starts right here, what comes out of our mouth and what we're telling ourselves. So that's right speech. Remember that the moral and ethical aspects of the Dhamma, right speech, action, livelihood, are within the context of the entirety of the Eightfold Path. They start from right view. They start from the view that clinging, craving, desire, and aversion cause stress, cause unhappiness, cause disenchantment. Where does right speech arise from? It arises from a competitive or aggressive nature with what's outside of us, with the person in front of us, or with the world in front of us.
Wrong speech.
Well, okay. But, yes, wrong speech. I mean, it could be right speech, too.
But right speech doesn't come out of competitive nature.
You're absolutely right. So, the first thing I'll say about that is the Buddha taught the Eightfold Path from the, more brings up the point though, from the positive aspects, you know, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right mindfulness, etc., implying that there's wrong things, there's wrong actions, there's wrong speech, there's wrong livelihood, there's wrong mindfulness, there's wrong meditation, there's wrong effort. And the reason why I bring that up, in the world today, we're not supposed to look at things that are wrong. We're supposed to remain positive all the time. Well, we can't do that. We have to be able to discriminate between what's supportive of the Dhamma, what's supportive of awakening, and what's not. Wrong speech is not supportive of the Dhamma, not only because it hurts other people, but because it leaves our minds so agitated that we can't possibly develop a deep level of concentration. We can't engage in right mindfulness or right meditation if we don't have the moral and ethical aspects of our lives in order first. You know, the Buddha taught an eightfold path that's both circular and linear. If we don't have those moral and ethical aspects under control, the rest of the Eightfold Path is not going to work. We can't just meditate ourselves into good behavior. You know, we can through moral behavior, we can develop a meditation practice, though. We can develop an understanding of the Eightfold Path. Beginning with right view, that clinging, craving, desire, and aversion cause the distraction of dukkha. Getting into right intention, the intention to put aside. That's what right intention is, putting aside clinging, craving, desire, and aversion. I'll just refer to that as clinging from now on, to save a few words out of this gabby mouth. Right intention is the intention to abandon clinging. Where does clinging arise? Where do we notice it? It's in our speech. You know? And it usually begins with we lie to defend this thing that we think we are, even if it's just small lies. We do it almost as a convenience. We say things that aren't true. That's the beginning aspect of right or wrong speech. We remain honest and truthful at all times. And I should qualify that with the wisdom to not be harmful. Sometimes telling the truth can hurt somebody. And that's when we remain silent. We don't always have to flap our gums. That's an aspect of right speech, is to know when to just remain silent. A lot of questions that were put through the Buddha, if you read the Pali Canon, you'll come across this over and over again. The Buddha's asked a question that if he answered the question would just lead to more confusion. And the Buddha just sat there. Oftentimes he didn't say, I don't have an answer. He didn't say, I don't want to answer it. He would usually just sit there. Because he also knew that any kind of qualification for his answer could create more confusion. So an aspect of right speech sometimes is just to be quiet. In fact, a lot of times it is. A lot of times right speech is just to keep your mouth shut. Any speech that is hurtful is wrong speech. We don't engage in gossip. We don't engage in idle chatter. And I know the world tends to live on idle chatter. Twitter and Facebook were founded on idle chatter. I hate to say it, but it's true. And that doesn't mean you should never get into Twitter or Facebook, but you should look at it. And what aspect of that is really idle chatter? And why is that so damaging? Why is idle chatter part of wrong speech? Because it's a constant distraction. And it usually leads to other people being more distracted, being more caught in dukkha. So it's twofold. We're causing harm to other people, and we're causing harm for ourselves. There's no reason for it. Another aspect of right speech is that it's necessary, that what's coming out of our mouth actually needs to be said. And there's a great deal of wisdom that's needed to understand that. And are we saying words, even if we're talking about the Dhamma, do we know that they're falling on deaf ears? If we know that, keep your mouth shut. You know, and I have to think about that often when I'm sitting up here. Because I can create just more confusion for people by what comes out of my mouth just because of where I'm sitting. You know, I can't sit up at every class and say, don't listen to me, and then start talking. But with great discernment, listen to other people. You know, does it fit in? And that person should also understand that what they're saying is necessary and useful. Say it in such a way. I've sat in front of teachers that obviously had a great understanding, but we're so enamored with the way that they presented things. They use the way they presented things to prove how much they understood. The Buddha talked in very, very common language. He never used any language that couldn't be understood by the people in front of him. That's important. That's part of right speech. It doesn't do anybody any good for me to let you know what an incredibly exalted grasp I have on the Dhamma by using big words that you can't understand. It's useless, and I'm wasting your time. I'm just using that as an example of wrong speech. Maury, you had your hand up.
Yeah, I did.
About 10 minutes ago.
Yes, I did have my hand up. Because one of the things that, a concrete example that I find sometimes, and like you're talking, and I'm thinking about a lot of things that I do that I don't think are helpful to me or to other people. For example, I talk about food a lot because it is something that I can distract myself into, you know, insanity with. Not because I want to, not because of dietary things, but there's a level of craving and energy behind, this is a habitual pattern, a habit energy of mine since I was young, to get lost in the tastes and the textures and the, you know, wanting it even more perfect and more colorful and more complex. And then I go around and I talk about it to other people. Oh, you know what I had last night? I had X, Y, Z, and it was really good. And this all arises to me out of a sense of self, out of I have an opinion, I know taste. and that does strong it, speech.
Where does it arise from, too? It arises from being, from joining with the food, from clinging to the food.
Correct. And there's a self that's arising in there. I think that all of the Dhamma is, you know, when we're looking at emptiness and etc., all wrong speech, wrong effort, wrong intention, all that arises from this sense of false attachment to a sense of self that wants to keep creating itself. And when I feel crappy about myself, you know, I'm going to go look for something to distract myself. I'm going to talk about somebody. I'm going to talk to somebody about food or about music or about pictures or about whatever it is. And it all comes from this as you say so clearly, it comes from an unsettledness, a dissatisfaction, a craving, and my experience has been that although the moral and ethical guidelines are there to help keep us on track, the more I have a strong meditation and mindfulness practice, the less that self and that looking outside arises. I'm filled from within. So they go, I don't engage in so much wrong speech when my Christian practice is strong. They feed each other.
It's an eightfold path.
So I'm really, looking forward to the speaking because I know this person is very active lately.
That
way too active, so we need to kind of come back.
The reason why it's directly applicable is because if we're on our cushions, we're developing a more concentrated mind. We're not distracted. It's really that simple. The word that's often used to describe that awakened mind is a mind of samadhi, meaning a non-distracted state, a mind that's in equanimity. It's not reactive. And if our minds are not reactive, our speech is not going to be reactive. We'll be able to know when to speak and when to keep our mouth shut. The emptiness, I know I said this just earlier today, the emptiness that the Buddha talks about is to be empty of attachment. And if we're empty of attachment, we're going to have very few words come out of our mouth, and the words that come out of our mouth are going to be useful. They're going to be helpful. They will be necessary. That's all part of right speech. In this world that we live in, it's very, very difficult to really practice right speech 100% of the time. You'll often appear aloof or arrogant, and that's where discernment comes in. We don't want you don't want other people to see you that way. It doesn't do me any good to have people see me as arrogant if I'm hoping to teach the Dhamma. So there's a fine line there. How do you engage people in a way that might at the surface be frivolous but turns into meaningful? It takes wisdom married to that compassion. The Buddhist path is a path of wisdom, virtue, and concentration, not just one. So we have to have great wisdom as we're developing virtue and concentration, or we'll become stale and arrogant. If it's just compassion that we think we need to express, that's coming from a position of clinging. Just thinking, my compassion's going to bowl over the world. Well, where does that arise from? My compassion's enough to change everything. You need to marry that with some wisdom, with some virtue, with right speech. We all know people that were great orators that destroyed countries. And I don't even have to say who that is. There's enough of them. We all just had an image of somebody who was a great speaker that destroyed countries and destroyed other people. Probably were 10 different images. We all know people that were great orators and brought people together. And you all just had different images of that. Some people thought of Nelson Mandela. Some people thought of Martin Luther King. Someone might have thought of Kennedy. We all had an image when I said that. That's the power that can come out of our mouths. It can be used for great destruction. It can be used to change people. The words that the Buddha used, he chose them very carefully. I've read an awful lot of the Pali Canon. One of the things that always struck me is the economy of words and how every word seemed to have a meaning in the context that the Buddha presented it in. That's the greatest example concrete example of right speech is the way the Buddha presented the Four Noble Truths throughout his teaching. And if you think about how the Four Noble Truths are presented, you know, as an aspect of right speech, there is dukkha. You know, it's right speech. It's helpful, doesn't hurt anyone. It leads to the end of suffering. It's not frivolous in any way. So that, I guess if I was going to say an example, a real good example of right speech is speech that fits into that context of the Eightfold Path. We don't have to look at life that as we're saviors for everyone. What we need to look at the Dhamma as is we're trying to save ourselves. The last words of the Buddha is that impermanence is relentless. Work diligently for your own salvation. The last words that the Buddha could have given could have been anything, and it was that. Work diligently for your own salvation. How do we do that? He gave us these simple guidelines, beginning with right speech. So maybe the kind of the sub-theme for the weekend could be that. Let's watch our speech. You know, the other aspect of right speech, and I touched on it, is what we tell ourselves. It should fit into those same guidelines. Is it helpful? Is it necessary what I'm saying to myself, or am I just caught up in idle chatter in my own head? I mean, that's mindlessness. That's monkey mind, is idle chatter. We can gain a level of concentration, a level of samadhi, so that we're not stuck in idle chatter in our own minds. And that's really the problem. It's that aspect of right speech that's going on between our own ears. The meditation technique that we use is designed just for that. If you think about the story I just told about the Buddha awakening, another way of saying Mara was just idle chatter going on in the Buddha's mind. And he kept coming back to the breath. He kept developing a deeper and deeper level of concentration so he wasn't distracted by the idle chatter going on in his own mind. The wrong speech. You know, you could say that the battle that the Buddha fought that last night of his awakening was a battle with right and wrong speech. What he was telling himself, what he allowed in his own mind. And we have that choice. You know, the other thing that as human beings we don't realize, we think that just because we think the way we think that we have to think that way. And we don't. We can change the way we think. And that's another point of this Dhamma and the practice. Because we've developed a conditioned mind doesn't mean that we have to continue to add to that conditioned mind. We have a right and a responsibility to be different, to not be caught up in the delusion of dukkha. The Dalai Lama said, the purpose of time is to awaken. Imagine that. Of all the things that the Dalai Lama could have said, that's the most important thing that he ever said. The reason why we're here, the reason why we're stuck in this moment by moment unfolding of time is to awaken. Damn it. It's to awaken. That's why we're here. Yeah. The purpose of time is to awaken. The purpose of this weekend is to awaken. And how do we awaken? If we believe in the Dhamma, we awaken through the Four Noble Truths. Take to it wholeheartedly. Again, coming back to why we're here this weekend. Take to the Dhamma wholeheartedly. Watch what comes out of your mouth. Watch what you're telling yourself. Not to beat yourself up. Simply to become aware of it. And when you recognize that it doesn't fit within those guidelines, let it go. Abandon it. Renounce it. You know, with all those words that we use. Don't engage in it. As Bob Newhart would say, stop it. Yeah. Stop it. And come back to the present moment. And when you see you do it again, whether it's on your cushion or walking upstairs later, stop it, recognize it, put it aside, and come back to the sensation of breathing. And that's the practice. That's the Dhamma practice. The Eightfold Path is so that we recognize when we're off the path, when we're stuck in one of those wrong aspects. If we didn't have the perspective of the right aspect, we wouldn't recognize when we're stuck in something else that is mindless. You know, the only kind of mindfulness that the Buddha taught was to be mindful of where we are in relation to that Eightfold Path. You know, I usually refer to it as a framework. It's a framework for awakening. You know, The Buddha taught the Eightfold Path as the path leading to the cessation of dukkha. What's after that? The Buddha wouldn't answer that question. He would sit silently. He would engage in right speech when somebody says, well, what happens after we awaken? And the Buddha would, I ain't telling. He'd say, I know, but I ain't telling. There's a great story called The Handful of Leaves. I probably would have told this later on, but it come up now. The Buddha's walking in through the forest with a bunch of his monk buddies. And they're asking him about all these different esoteric questions. And the Buddha got a little bit tired of it, and he reached down, he picked up a handful of leaves, and I'm paraphrasing this, I always tell it a little bit differently, but the point's the same. He picked up a handful of leaves, and he says, with all the knowledge and all the, in the whole universe, what is greater? All the leaves on the tree, or the knowledge that I hold in my hand, you know, depicted by this handful of leaves? And the monk said, well, it's in the leaves of the tree. He says, but what's the useful knowledge? What do you need to awaken? And the Buddha opened his hand, and the leaves fell out. That's the amount of knowledge that you need to awaken. Don't worry about all the rest of it. Take to the Dhamma, awaken, and then all those other things that will be given to you. You don't need to learn about bilocating. You don't need to know about different dimensions. You don't need to know about astral travel or all the other things. You don't have to know about omniscience. You don't have to know about where you go after you die. You don't have to know about where you're going in the next moment. You don't have to know about what happens when you awaken. You'll know it when you awaken. The Buddha also knew there's a great story that rolls throughout the Pali Canon, and it's Vachagoda. You always heard me talk about that. But I just love this story. Vachagoda was a wanderer. He'd come and he'd seek the Buddha out, and he'd have these great questions. What is the nature of the self after awakening? What happens when we die? How many other dimensions are there? Is life finite or infinite? And the Buddha would listen to it a little bit, and he'd always say the same thing. He'd say, Vachagoda, your questions are confusing you. And then he would sit in silence. And Vachagoda would go, and he'd wander around for 6 months or another year, and he'd come back with this basically the same kind of questions. And the Buddha's answer always was, your questions are confusing me. Meaning that I've given you everything you need to awaken, to answer your questions. Stop asking the questions, engage in the Dhamma. Bring your minds into the present moment. We don't have to discount anything that we hold important if we weigh it against that Eightfold Path. Is my life, the way I'm living it, what I'm holding on to, does it fit into those eight aspects? And if it doesn't, it's not going to hurt to let it go. And it'll lead to lasting peace and happiness. We're not letting go of anything that's of any value. We're not letting go of anything that has any permanence or any substantiality. If it's ideas we're letting go, let go of them. You know, if it's objects, it doesn't mean that we end up living in the forest under a tree. You know, we let go of our attachment to our house, we still live in the house. Let go of attachment to our car, we're still going to get in our car and drive home. But we don't need it for our happiness anymore. Our minds can rest in the present moment without being attached to anything. And it's in this present moment that lasting peace and happiness occurs. Not in the next present moment. Not in something that gave us pleasure yesterday or a moment ago. It's bringing our minds into the present moment, free of the distraction of clinging and craving and desire. That's a distraction of dukkha. That's what the Buddha talked about when he explains awakening. So it's not so much the word dukkha or the experience of dukkha that's the problem. It's the preoccupation with it. And clinging is another way to say preoccupation. That's the teaching on awakening. That's the teaching on right speech. I hope did I explain it well enough that you have an understanding of what right speech is? Is there any other questions on it? Let this be the sub theme for the weekend. And if it comes up again, let's keep talking about it. Because right speech is really, it's central enough that we can use it to understand the whole rest of the Dhamma. If we look at what's coming out of our mouth and what we're telling ourselves, we have a pretty good idea of the state of our minds. And if we recognize that the state of our minds is more on the wrong side than the right side, recognize the wrong side and put it aside. That's the awareness. Anthony DeMello said in that great book that I mention often, Awareness. Awareness isn't change. So recognizing where we're engaged in wrong speech isn't change. But the recognition is the power to change. Anthony DeMello's quote was, awareness isn't change, but it's the power to change. Another word to use for that awareness is mindfulness. If we're going to change, if we're going to develop a life of lasting peace and happiness, we first must be mindful of the things that are causing us unhappiness for the sole purpose of putting them aside, of letting them go. Not for any other reason. Not to look at our attachments and say how stupid I could be or how bad am I. If we're engaged in really compulsive and hurtful behavior, a lot of people will beat themselves up. People that are stuck in addictions will usually beat the hell out of themselves for being stuck in the addiction, rather than just seeing it mindfully and saying, this is something that I need to change, period. Those that are, pick anything that's destructive, usually will judge ourselves harshly because we're engaged in it. That's a surefire way to hold on to it. If you want to change anything, treat yourself gently. Release the judgment, bring your minds into the present moment, and it's gone. Your experience of it is gone. It's that kind of practical teaching that the Buddha teaches. Right speech. So just very quickly, right action and right livelihood is the same. It's the same thing. It has the same qualities. In our actions, right speech, action, and livelihood is often referred to as in thought, word, and deed. We engage in behavior that is remain harmless, and that is purposeful. That what we're doing, what we're engaging in, has some value towards it. Not value in the phenomenal world as much as value in awakening and not causing other people to be more confused. That's why hurtful speech or hurtful action has such a karmic impact, because we're also taking other people further and further away from the truth because of the suffering we're creating other people. And then that other subtle aspect of right speech, not letting people by our speech, oh, that's okay, dear, you're okay. Letting people feel good about themselves when what they really need is to be pointed out that what you're doing isn't helpful. And the word commonly used is enabling. When we're enabling other people to continue suffering, we're causing more suffering. That's wrong speech. Sometimes we got to stand up for ourselves because what we're doing is allowing other people to hurt us. That's right speech. So sometimes right speech is not always pleasant. It could be this kind of thing where we say, you can't treat me like that anymore. That's right speech. Even though it's taken in the context of confrontation. Matt.
Sure, so something that came out of that, what John just said as a concrete example, would be kind of boundary issues. And looking at where we have boundary issues with certain people, with certain situations, with certain things, and seeing how what we say to people or what we don't say to people continues those boundary issues. Usually when you're working with boundary issues, it has a lot to do with what you say to yourself, what you say to other people, and how you're communicating. How do you communicate directly, clearly, presently? Mm-hmm. That's how you can make those changes.
Right? Give an example of that.
Someone who some people, like an in-law or a mother or a father, where every time they're around that person, they get into a particular type of speech, they say certain things, they act a certain way, and the mother or the father or the in-laws or something treat them in a certain way. Mm-hmm. And it's probably been that way for a long, long time. And we allow that to happen by not clearly, directly communicating with them and saying, I don't really like that, or stop.
Stop it.
Or, a million other things, you know.
Right.
So those, that's something that I see as where we can apply our speech. We can think about that and go, okay, if I was going to practice right speech in this moment, what would that look like? You know, that would look like, to grow you, you asshole.
Yeah.
No, not, you know what I'm saying. You wouldn't do that, but you would clearly and directly communicate what it is that was coming up for you. And that way, you're taking responsibility for what's coming up in you. And you're creating a space for the other person to recognize that and take responsibility for what they're contributing to this relationship. So in that way, if both people can do that, that's huge. If two people can, you know, openly and directly take responsibility for their interaction at the same time, that changes things.
And that's a very, very helpful example, because as I was listening to you share that I was thinking, you know, those boundary issues in families, there's such habit energy, you know, and at work, I want everybody to be happy, but I have to direct their behavior.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And when I am able to be direct and say what I really think and feel kindly, then I'm able to let go of it. And that's where the interruption of the clinging occurs. So thank you. Well said.
When you had said, I want everyone to be happy, that's an attachment, right? And
totally.
We totally recognize that. And I think that's what happens in in-laws, you know. We our wanting of comfort is the attachment to things being different than they are. And they're not. But situations like that aren't pleasant. And if we allow somebody to continue to speak harshly or demean us, they're harming themselves. And you know, so our responsibility is to with compassion, to say that, I like what you said, you know, I don't like that.
Yeah.
That is not a way that I'm going to continue a conversation if that type of speech goes on. And then it's clear, and the other person then has a choice for how they're going to continue.
And in that, you know, we have to, as a part of taking responsibility for what's coming up, what's coming up when that happens? Guilt? Do we feel guilty? Do we feel ashamed of stopping that kind of abuse? There's nothing wrong there. We just have to pay attention to that. And if that comes
again,
up,
like some enmeshment, and that again is more clinging.
Yeah.
And so it's really an opportunity to see that whole tangled scheme.
Yeah.
Well, and some of it is to save face, in it, that we don't want to be the one that points this out, but to either through wanton participation or just tacit approval, we engage in gossip or some other aspect of wrong speech.
Mm-hmm.
We're furthering another person's suffering because of that too. Even though it might be uncomfortable to say, I don't want to talk about people that aren't standing in front of me. It might create an uncomfortable situation. It's actually the most loving thing we can do in that situation. You might lose a friend over it, but it's still necessary. You might lose a relative over it. Even something as constant idle chatter. You know, we live in the world, we're going to say things that we don't really have to say all the time. If we're too rigid with any of this, we're not going to be able to live in the world, is what I'm saying. But we have to recognize where it's going and the damage that it's doing as far as keeping people in this deluded state of mind. I'm sorry, Lisa, you've had your hand up for...
Yeah, the thing that I struggle with right speech and wrong speech is it's a judgment. And I really struggle with judgment because judgment has never served me well toward myself or toward others. And so I struggle with that, just the terminology. What I'm hearing... Joy, you said it really well. I don't remember exactly the words you used, but speaking kindly with, you know, helpful, like, in other words, the intent is pure and clean. My intent might be pure and clean. And I do sit a couple times a day, and I come to these classes. I'm in a very different space than probably 75% of the people that I interact with.
Yeah.
So I can only be accountable for me. And looking at what I can do and how I can approach it, but not judging what that other person is doing. And that, for me, has been such a strong shift in interactions with others. So that when I'm bringing up something in a dance that I've been doing for 30 years, and I want to change the dance, and I want to change my step, it's really cautious. I have to be very cautious that I'm not telling them or letting them think what they're doing is wrong.
Yeah.
Because that isn't for me to judge. I can only stand up for, if it is bringing something up for me, to know what it is that's bringing up for me, because a lot of times it might be guilt, or it might be, for me, I have, like, my abandonment issues is a big thing for me. So if I'm afraid somebody's not going to like me, that's an automatic space for me to go to. And so I'm putting a lot of stuff that might not be anywhere near what's going on in their space. So I guess that's the only thing that I struggle with, is that's why I try to keep it very simple to myself by saying, am I showing up in a way that is representative of what is meaningful and what is the intent? And I guess maybe, like I said, I struggle with the good and the bad, you know, the good and the wrong, the right and the wrong.
There's a difference between seeing things clearly and judgment. Discernment is different than judgment. So seeing someone as a real butthole because of the way they act is different than seeing a person that it would be best if they changed their behavior. You know, the judgment is seeing someone in a harsh way. Recognizing, a good example, another concrete example, I don't know if women do this, but I know men, when there's more than two or three of them, they like to tell dirty jokes. And I've always hated it. But I used to laugh at it and make believe I liked it. For the last many number of years, I walk away. I usually don't tell people that you shouldn't talk that way, or you shouldn't tell filthy jokes or talk about women that way or anything else. And I'm not judging those people in a harsh way, but it's also not something that I want to participate in. It's not right speech, for one thing. So there's a difference between seeing, exercising the discernment of wisdom and judging people harshly. We don't have to judge people harshly to know that their behavior is not something that's skillful.
To me, that's still a judgment, because I don't want to judge whether somebody else's speech is skillful or not. I want to judge.
Well,
all I can do is step back and take ownership for the way I show up. Because maybe for where they are with what they're doing with their lives, that is actually right for them.
Well,
not be for me.
What you're right to not want to participate in it, and that's basically the same thing. I'm not saying that you should tell people that you're engaged in wrong speech, you know, that but to recognize it. You recognize it's not something you want to do. That's different. And it's not, we don't, I use an example of orators that destroyed countries. But I don't see those people I don't see Adolf Hitler as somebody who is an evil person that deserves to rot in hell. I just see him as a very disturbed individual who's subject to incredible suffering. Because of his deep level of ignorance and attachment to self, he caused incredible suffering for other people. But it's all arose out of that same ignorance that we're all subject to as human beings. You know, so I don't judge him in a negative way, but certainly his actions, you know, and that's the difference. You know?
And I agree with that, and that's actually similar to the way I think. It's just that when I hear good and right and wrong and good and bad, and I know when others hear right and wrong and good and bad, there's a distinction that's being made a lot of times. That's judgment. So I in this context,
it can be, but we have to have we have to give ourselves the
Does it create the conditions that you want? Is the speech that one is using, is it effective in the mind state and in lessening attachments? Like, that's all that it means. I mean, I think
I agree with you. with that. That's I just get stuck with the wording.
Yeah, we often do. We have to give ourselves the ability to see what's skillful and what's not, but in a dispassionate way. You know, taking up a cause against something requires great judgment and great attachment. Recognizing things that are less than skillful, that are less than supportive of the Dhamma, and not engaging in them or supporting other people. You know, that's the other side of that. Not supporting other people, through tacit approval, letting people think that their behavior is okay because it's causing them harm. There's no compassion. They're married with wisdom. So it gets a little tricky, and there's an aspect of our world today that you should never look at anything positive or anything negative. You know, always stay positive. Only look at the positive. Well, if you only look at the positive, you're never going to understand the things you need to change. You know, you can't look at life that way. Life is part of life is recognizing suffering. You know, that's the first noble truth. Awakening is understanding suffering in ourselves and others. And we got to be able to look at it. We've got to have the courage to look at it. Be present with it and recognize those things in ourselves that we need to change so that we no longer continue it for ourselves and others. Matt and I were talking about this on the way up here too. If we really want to change the problems of the world, everybody needs to sit down on their cushion and engage in the Eightfold Path. Because we're never going to change the problems, all the wars and the hate and all the terrible things that go on in the world that are going to continue to go on until people wake up. You know, if anybody's going to take up a cause, you know, you listen to who you're talking to, but if anybody's going to take up a cause, it's a cause to awaken. You know, that's the most important thing. All the wars, all the terrible things that happen in the world arise out of ignorance. And what changes ignorance is wisdom. You know, this is a path of wisdom, virtue, and concentration. It's a way to end all the suffering in the world. I don't know if it's going to happen, but I know it's the only way it's going to happen.
Yeah, we're not separate from all the ignorance and all that.
And we're not going to legislate it away. We're not going to create the world's biggest army to scare people into it. That's never worked. There's nothing that's worked that has done anything for the illumination of mankind except the Dhamma, except the truth. You know, in whatever form it is, but you know, this is the path of lasting peace and happiness. It's not something else, you know. It's not trying to convince groups of people to believe in a certain way. It's putting aside every one of our beliefs and seeing what's there. You know, and this Eightfold Path, and maybe we did get a little bit off it tonight, now that I'm talking about it and talking it out. We need to keep it simple and focused too. We don't have to try to find situations where it doesn't apply. Find where it does. You know, find out how our behavior fits in within this Eightfold Path. Charlie.
Yeah, I've really enjoyed this conversation we've had so far.
Me too.
I've enjoyed it because it brings to light the complexity of life, of real life. Mm. I mean, there's great complexity and great subtlety in all of our interactions. And try and boil it down to something simple that fits into an Eightfold Path, to me, does a disservice to the Dharma. Life is complicated, and people are complicated, and interactions are extremely complicated. And so to gain wisdom and insight, I mean, it takes a lot of life sometimes to live through things, to learn the lessons of life, to get a sense for how this all works.
Yeah.
So I've really enjoyed this conversation, because to me it's highlighted that. And sometimes when you put forth it's a simple Eightfold Path, to me it does a disservice to it. It's not simple. Life isn't simple.
Yeah, but you got to be careful that you don't allow that to lead to more confusion. Again, the reason why the Buddha taught to weigh our behaviors into that framework is because it brings it back into a less confusing state. You can always find exceptions in the phenomenal world to anything, you know, not just the Eightfold Path. Bring up one fact and you can find a million different things that prove that fact is wrong. You know, you can get caught endlessly in that loop. What we're talking about, we're not talking about absolutes either. We're talking about a process and a practice. You know, so Once we awaken to the Eightfold Path doesn't exist anymore. It's not, you know, it's not an absolute. It's something to get us. It's a vehicle for awakening. And if we discount it too much, it'll become useless. It won't be a Dhamma anymore. It'll be something else. One of the problems with Buddhism today is all the adaptations that have been made. And the compensations that have been made for people wanting to believe it should be a certain way. And that has diluted the Buddhism to the point where it's not really Buddhism, and it's certainly not effective. So I agree with what you're saying, but you need to be cautious about this. It's not, there's nothing absolute about it, but it's just a framework for practice. You know, it's like baseball practice. You know, some people can hit a fastball, some can't. Some can hit a curveball, it's still baseball. You know?
I
think we are.
It's a framework, but life is complicated, so fitting your life experiences into that framework and then coming up with some right speech or deciding what the right action is or the right livelihood is complicated.
I hear that, Charlie. I also think that that the Eightfold Path can hold complexity and can allow for that complexity between people, between cultures, between situations, between friends and family, because it's human. I mean, it's all each of those things on the path are human things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and humans are complex, but we share all of those aspects of the path.
Mm-hmm.
So we can find a simple connection between very complex situations sometimes through this shared human thing, which is April, or some aspect of the April.
And the purpose is to develop understanding. And it's to develop an understanding of clinging, craving, desire, and aversion. It's about awakening. It's about understanding the emptiness of clinging. And so within that perspective, that's the point. Everything can fit into that. And the moral and ethical aspects can be applied to anything. And all of that can really be boiled down to remaining harmless. You know, and everything can fit into that. I understand the resistance to simplify things too much. But in the context of putting aside clinging, craving, desire, and aversion, we remain harmless because harmfulness to others and ourselves arises out of an ego self. It arises out of this impersonal, insubstantial self that's prone to suffering. Again, the Buddha was not concerned with having us understand everything in the world. He was concerned with us understanding how to put aside our own distraction caused by dukkha, period. It's not. It doesn't have to answer to everything, you know, like some systems do. It just has to deliver the end of suffering.
Nothing feeds the ego more than wanting to understand everything.
Yeah, and that's again the Buddha. When people try to bring that in, the Buddha would either keep his mouth shut or he'd say, "Your question is causing your confusion." You know, he wasn't concerned about ultimate truth. The Buddha said, I know everything. I mean, he said that. He said, I got all the answers. You don't. But I'm not going to give them to you because you don't need them. Your problem is suffering. I can tell you how to stop it.
And as just piggybacking on what Ram said, it's not an intellectual dharma. It's a moment to moment.
Yeah.
Each moment after moment. That's, you know, why this weekend, as we progress, it's going to be a beautiful weekend because Matt was so skillful at getting into the felt sense. And the more we get out of the thinking mind into the felt sense, we become in tune with what's arising in our body moment to moment. And we can let go of it and rest in the peace and the ease and the spaciousness of our true nature.
Yeah.
But right, you know, right now, we're all like, I know I am. I can't argue with that one. And, you know, it's all in my head, and I keep having to come back over and over to my breath and my body, and where am I tightening around what's being said, and where am I softening around it, and, you know, there's all this stuff rising up inside of me. And that's what I think, I can just feel a resistance, I can feel it.
Yeah, that's really the guts of it. You know, that's the practice. This is what being a human is, and it's available material for us to practice with. You know, these are actual sensations that are arising in the body that we're aware of, and we're watching ourselves want to do something about it. We either want to get away from it, or we want to grab onto it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's happening. That's what we're doing. Can we see that? You know? And can we let it go?
Mm-hmm. You know?
And let's just all keep doing it this weekend. This is why I love this. You know, this is why I love being here with everybody. Because these kinds of things come up and we get to get to share.
Practice great speech.
Yeah, practice it. Yeah.
Great body.
Yeah.
And
Deb, you had a question?
No wrong stuff.
Well, actually, through the discussion, I started feeling a little frightened, because sometimes in this kind of situation where we talk about it's a beautiful place and we have time for ourselves, but things start coming up.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know, it almost overwhelms you sometimes. And my question was, is that when you try to just get in the present moment, or do you confront those things? Because that's where you're going to change.
I'm not quite sure I followed you. Confront what's causing some uneasiness?
Really kind of emotional reactions where things hurt, or you feel like you can't deal with something.
Mm.
Do you know what I'm saying? That you feel overwhelmed. That this should be such a positive.
Some of that is a conditioned response. You know, so everybody would feel that differently. Because of our conditioned mind, we experience any kind of situation differently than other people. You know, I thought this was a wonderful discussion tonight, but apparently some people didn't.
I thought that discussion was interesting and very good and useful for me in terms of right speech. But I just meant it got around to this idea of what I'm taking to the thing you were saying, that if you don't look at these things, you can't change them.
Oh, I get your point. Practicing the Dhamma doesn't always have to feel wonderful. In fact, it often doesn't. But that's not a benchmark to weigh its usefulness, that I always feel good. In fact, if you want something that always feels good, you know, cocaine works pretty good. Alcohol, going to the horse racing, whatever it is. So we can't use a pleasant feeling, that's just another attachment, to say, well, okay, this is good. You know, I'll continue to engage in it because I always feel wonderful. It's not going to work that way. You know, the Buddha confronted every one of the worst things in his life as he gained awakening. He happened to do it in a period of 40 days. We might do it a little bit longer. But there's going to be times when it's unpleasant. There's going to be times when this new view that we're acquiring doesn't fit in an old view, and that's uncomfortable. It's not always uncomfortable either. The word that the Buddha used was ehipasiko, come and see for yourself. So in an overall way, the Buddha's saying, take to this wholeheartedly and then see how your life is going. Are you more mindfully present? Are you, in general and overall, more at peace? Are you more happy? Do you have less confusion in your life? Are you more present with people? Do you have more loving relationships? Is your life more simpler than it used to be? Are you, in a general way, more at peace? But going through it, there's I don't say it as much anymore, but I used to say it a lot. This is a practice of ease and joy, but it's not for the faint of heart. Because you come up against every single one of your most loved views of yourself, you know, including confrontation. You know. The other aspect of the Dhamma, or another way to say it, is it's the ultimate way of standing up for yourself. You know, it's acquiring an understanding of who you are and letting that be enough. And not in an arrogant way. But it does exclude a lot of the stuff that goes on in the world. You know, if the Buddha was the biggest radical of his time, and probably of all time, if you really look at what he did. And in order for him to teach the Dhamma, he often said, it's this and it's not that. And we have to have the courage to recognize in ourselves that it's this and it's not that. We have to be able to make those choices. More.
I don't know if this is what you're referring to at all, but like if I'm sitting here and I can feel a tightening around something that's said that kind of makes me feel uncomfortable, it's fear, it's resistance, it's aversion, right? What I try to do is be aware that I'm tightening against something. So whether I feel my heart going faster or my stomach getting tighter or my breath stops a little bit, because fear will do that, right? Or some type of resistance, usually my belly will tighten. And then I recognize that I'm just moving myself away from the present moment. You know, some self is there. So to me, like you could, each moment one can be practicing, oh, okay, I feel resistance. Like you don't have to like use a word, but just recognize what's going on internally, if not with a statement, like oh tightness, you know, just the felt sense. And then you'll come back to the present moment. That usually will dissolve. I'll just say that for me, once I look at something, no matter what it is, tightness in my shoulder, there it goes. You know, it's gone. Neck, gone. Eyes tight, tongue, tense, relaxed. That when my tongue is tense, it means that I'm trying to hold against something that's going on right now. Thinking mind is craving after something. I'm in the past. When I get real slack, you know, it's because I'm hanging out. I'm dull, you know. When my tongue is there, I'm resisting something. So not that those things are that relevant. I just know that I'm not in the present moment. So once I see it or feel it, I can let it go, and I'm back to what's really happening right now. So, I don't know if that makes any sense to you.
No, I think I'm maybe not there yet. I have trouble getting in the present moment. Uh-huh. So I'm really not in, I don't think I have the felt sense. I think that's something I need to develop, if that makes sense. I don't think I'm very connected to my body at this point.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly know a point when I live about, you know, 10 feet from my body, absolutely. So,
So, yeah, we will. We're not going to have a meditation session tonight because we're going to do the, Denise is going to take us through the Himalayan healing bowls in just a moment. It was a wonderful discussion tonight. I think we've established a deep understanding of what right speech is, especially in relation to the entirety of the Eightfold Path. The important thing, again, this weekend, we're on retreat. Be very, very gentle with yourselves. Be very loving with yourselves. And watch your speech. You know, use your speech as a way of enhancing your understanding of this Eightfold Path. It is simple. It is direct. It will develop lasting peace and happiness without the distraction of having to hold on to anything. So anything, what comes up, a lot of our attachments are felt as discomfort in our bodies. It's a good way of recognizing that. Part of the Dhamma is not insisting that I always feel a certain way. You know, recognizing that what's going on, we don't have to figure out why. We don't have to find a blame for it. When we're uncomfortable in our bodies, it's simply there to recognize that this is what I'm feeling in this present moment. Not in a way to change it. If there's pain, there's pain. sit and come back to your breath. It'll change long and, you know, quick enough. That's impermanence. You know? If we're in an interpersonal relationship that's uncomfortable, you don't have to do anything about it except engage in right speech, action, and livelihood in it with deep mindfulness and concentration. Then you won't cause anybody or yourself any harm. It's about that. I don't know that I'm going to talk too much about karma and rebirth this weekend, maybe Saturday night. But karma is simply the present moment unfolding of past intentional acts impacted by our present moment mindfulness. There's nothing magical or mystical about that. If we want to end our karma, stop reacting in this present moment. You know, again, it's very practical. We're not trying to do anything. We're not trying to change the world. We're trying to change our minds. And we change our mind beginning initially with right view. You know, and then everything else changes from that. When we change our, I started this talk tonight with, when we change our point of view, we change our experience. You know? And all the rest of this, all the things that we talked about tonight, are just, it's just a guideline. It's a framework for moving in that direction. And it's a framework that begins with gentleness. You know, it's a framework that begins with no judgment. You know, no harsh judgment, I should say. But discernment, you know, understanding where we're going. So that's enough for tonight. We're going to, if Denise is ready, we'll have a healing bowl session. Tomorrow's, you all have the schedule. Maura is having a meditation at 7. In this room, Maura?
Yes.
Okay.
Unless I
want
to come to room 9.
Denise, how are you? Is there any other quick question or comment on our talk tonight? Okay, good. Where would you like us? What would you like us to do?
Thank you for listening. For more Dhamma talks and articles, please visit crossrivermeditation.com. We rely on donations from our listeners to provide these talks. If you have found this talk helpful in developing your understanding of the Dhamma, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. This talk is copyrighted and is made available under Creative Commons 4.0 license. Please visit crossrivermeditation.com for use and distribution information. Peace.